Hi, this is Ian Wolfe, producer, host and writer for Diffusion Science Radio. I need your support. You can support Diffusion by downloading a free Audible audiobook from audibletrial.com/science. Just for getting you to try them out, Audible will pay me a small reward. Or you could click on an Amazon link on diffusionradio.com and Amazon will kick a few percent of what you pay them my way. Please, make a donation directly with the PayPal button on www.diffusionradio.com.
Diffusion, the international science radio show.
We have a bouncer and the doors of perception.
The good, the bad, the ugly.
It gets pretty exciting.
The myths, the truths.
Toxicology.
Astro-seismology.
Magnetism.
The dark side.
Genetically engineered potatoes.
Planetoid.
Planetoid.
I love that word.
Hello and welcome to Diffusion. Sit back and relax while we inject weird and wonderful science directly into your brain. I'm Ian Wolfe. On this edition, part two of Canadians in Space. But first up, here's the news. Healthy high heels? High heels are notoriously painful to wear and have been likened to a modern form of foot binding. Using new materials, Thesis Couture claimed to have designed a shoe that spreads the load more evenly over the foot, with a high heel that absorbs impact, and a design that makes stilettos more stable while still being fashionable. The team includes a rocket scientist, an engineer, an astronaut, a fashion expert, and an orthopedic surgeon. Their design replaces the steel shank that serves as the spine of the shoe with a strong but flexible and light plastic resin. This way, as well as offering proper support, it absorbs more of the force from the impact of walking. When the wearer is standing still, the pressure is on their toes, but when they walk, the pressure is placed on their heel, more evenly dividing the load and reducing the impact of each step by up to 50%. They've replaced the traditional cardboard lining with comfortable aerospace-grade foam known as thermoplastic polyurethane. They've also doubled the width of the rectangular stiletto heel to make the whole thing more stable. They claim that although the heel height will be a little under 7.5 centimetres or 3 inches high, it'll look like it's 10 centimetres or 4 inches high. Although the shoe will be much more comfortable than current high heels, it won't be as comfortable as sneakers. The Thesis Couture team includes SpaceX technical wizard Garrett Reisman, an astronaut, and rocket scientist Hans Konigsmann, fashion technologist Amanda Parks, British orthopaedic surgeon Andy Goldberg, and Matt Thomas, director of mechanical engineering at Oculus VR, the pioneering virtual reality firm, all led by Dolly Singh, former executive at Elon Musk's SpaceX space transport company. The first limited edition stilettos will be sold near September this year for around $900. Within the next 5 years, the company plans to drop their price to $300 and license the technology so that all high heels in the world are made their way. Looking hot shouldn't hurt. No vaping for minors. The right-wing Liberal National New South Wales government put on hold laws to restrict minors from obtaining electronic cigarettes after members of parliament were approached by a lobby firm representing major tobacco companies. They wanted more time to debate the amendments that would have restricted the public use of electronic cigarettes in line with restrictions on tobacco products. This should dispel any remaining doubts that vaping is now being pushed by big tobacco. The British Medical Journal reports that every major tobacco company now sells electronic cigarettes. You put your vaping fluid that you've bought into your electronic vapor that you might have bought elsewhere, and the device heats the fluid to create a cloud of hot vapor that you inhale. About 70% of the fluid smoked in electronic cigarettes contain nicotine. 2 weeks after the laws were put on hold, a watered-down version of the legislation was passed. The sale of e-cigarettes to minors will be outlawed, their use in cars with children present will be banned and marketing will be restricted. E-cigarettes can still be smoked in enclosed spaces such as cafes, on public transport, and even in schools after the government refused a push by the Greens and Labor to have the devices treated like tobacco. So legally, kids can't buy vaping fluid, but they could legally smoke electronic cigarettes at school. Greens health spokesman Jeremy Buckingham vaped from an e-cigarette in the New South Wales upper house to demonstrate the loopholes that have been left wide open. Smokers are now just 18% of the state's population. Meanwhile, New South Wales has legislated to ban smoking old-style tobacco products, like cigarettes, cigars and pipes, in outdoor restaurant and cafe areas from the 8th of July. Vape 'em if you got 'em. Hello, Pluto! On the 14th of July, in just 2 weeks' time, NASA's New Horizons spacecraft will fly through the Pluto system. Pluto is a dwarf planet with 5 moons. Charon, Nix, Hydra, Kerberos, and Styx. When the New Horizons spacecraft left Earth over 9 years ago, Pluto was known as just a planet, with Charon its only moon. New Horizons is now 4.5 light hours away, powered by plutonium. The sunlight that far away is just too faint for solar. There are mysteries around Pluto and Charon. Since New Horizons launched, the pressure of the nitrogen, methane, and carbon dioxide atmosphere has more than doubled. Yet Pluto is bleeding atmosphere into space. How has it not run out? It's being renewed from somewhere, and New Horizons may find out. Charon is covered with icy patches of ammonia hydrates and water crystals, but they should have evaporated under the bombardment of cosmic rays and ultraviolet radiation it's bathed in. Somehow, it's being renewed. On the way to Pluto, New Horizons' telescopic long-range reconnaissance imager showed us that Charon has a dark pole rather than a white pole, a mysterious dark region that forms a kind of antipolar cap. Amongst the 7 instruments on board the spacecraft is the Venetia Burney Student Dust Counter, designed by undergraduate students from the University of Colorado to measure the dust that hits the spacecraft as it crosses the solar system. The dust counter uses detectors made from a plastic film called polyvinylidene fluoride. These observations will advance our understanding of the origin and evolution of the solar system and help scientists study planet formation in disks of dust around other stars. New Horizons will be taking pictures, video and measurements as it approaches Pluto and its moons, passes through the Pluto system and exits out the other side, then continues on further into the Kuiper Belt. Having travelled 5 billion kilometres to reach Pluto, the New Horizons spacecraft may travel another billion to visit another Kuiper Belt object. The target is still to be decided. Kuiper Belt objects are so far away from the Sun that they're almost unchanged for billions of years, so they can tell us a lot about the origins of our solar system. New Horizons will start sending photos 2 days out from the flyby just to make sure we get something, even if things went wrong. After almost 10 years and 5 billion kilometres, it's a real credit to the team at NASA that everything is still going to plan. Look out for the video streams and photos as we approach the 14th of July, so you can watch history happening. Space weapons for Canberra. From their mountain lair outside Canberra, based at Mount Stromlo, Australian company Electro-Optic Systems are experimenting with ground-to-orbit laser beams to nudge space junk before it can hit satellites or the International Space Station. In addition, the American government, in collaboration with Electro-Optic Systems, is relocating an 80-ton space surveillance telescope from the US to Exmouth in Western Australia. The telescope will be able to track everything from Chinese satellites to space garbage using tracking technology from the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. They will use high-powered lasers to zap space junk, ablating the surface so that it vaporizes to push the junk out of orbit. Space junk is accumulating at an ever faster rate and is already an occasional hazard for astronauts at the International Space Station. Astronomers warn that if we don't do something about all the flying junk, it will grow to the point that the Earth will be orbited by a permanent belt of debris that stops us safely launching any spacecraft, a point called the Kessler syndrome. The Space Environment Management Cooperative Research Centre is based at Mount Stromlo outside Australia's capital city. It involves collaboration between EOS Space Systems, Lockheed Martin, the NASA Ames Research Centre, Japan's National Institute of Information and Communications Technology, Australian telecommunications giant Optus, and Australia's RMIT University. The aim is to move space debris with ground-based lasers that can move an object by 100 metres over a 24-hour period. They will do this by applying an amount of energy equal to the light pressure from the sun for 5 to 10 minutes. If the junk is nudged the right way, it falls low enough to burn up in the atmosphere. They start with a 10 kilowatt laser using adaptive optics to keep the laser on target and to minimise how much the beam spreads out. The RazorView system on Mount Stromlo has tracked hundreds of tiny objects, some less than 10 centimetres across. The original paper suggesting the Mount Stromlo space laser comes from NASA's Ames Space Research Centre, who published a paper in 2011 called Orbital Debris-Debris Collision Avoidance. They make the point that previous suggestions for moving space junk used very high-powered military lasers that heated up the surface of debris to cause a spot to vaporise and act like a mini rocket engine. The authors were concerned that this is also easily interpreted as a threatening military weapon. The 10 kilowatt lasers applying light pressure are 1,000 times less powerful than the zapping military-style lasers used in Exmouth. In addition to the photon pressure junk nudging laser, the Space Environment Management Cooperative Research Centre lists on its website a project called Adaptive Optics and Energy Transmission Through the Atmosphere, which is about allowing high-powered lasers to travel through the atmosphere in a controlled way. This sounds like the project in Exmouth. The Space Environment Management Cooperative Research Centre on Mount Stromlo received $20 million from the Australian Government's Department of Industry, $40 million from the Japanese Government, the Australian National University, Lockheed Martin, Optus, NASA, RMIT and EOS Space Systems, who also donated $90 million worth of research infrastructure. So we have a multinationally funded low-powered laser in Canberra gently nudging space junk out of harm's way, while making sure nobody feels threatened. Meanwhile, on the other side of the continent, the same company is working solely with the US government, building very high-power lasers to aggressively zap space junk in a way that looks very much like threatening military technology. Electro-optic systems also make remote weapon stations. Hopefully, there won't be an international incident. Listening to Ian Wolfe on Diffusion Science Radio. Send emails to science@diffusionradio.com. We're brought to you across Australia on the Community Radio Network and podcast over the internet on www.diffusionradio.com. And now for part two of Mark Baudry's interview about what Australia can learn from Canada's successful space industries. Mark Baudry is Managing Director of Hexigeo Group, a Sydney-based geospatial services brokerage firm. Before locating to Sydney recently, he worked for one of Canada's main space contractors, McDonnell Detweiler & Associates, MDA. They developed Canada's space robotics capacity and built and operate Canada's Earth observation satellites. This time I began by asking Mark, what is EarthCast?
EarthCast is another, that's kind of an interesting development. The person who developed it was a MDA guy, a guy I know very well, and they were approached by the Russians to develop a, to put a SAR sensor on the ISS, because the ISS is split between the American and the Russian payload, and the Russians wanted to put a radar on the ISS. And through discussions, through meetings in Moscow, they got the idea to put a high-definition video camera which had never been done in space. The only video that you ever got were basically the ones that were held by the astronauts in the ISS looking at Earth with a video camera, but actually putting a video camera on a swivel that can look at Earth with a resolution of 1.1 meter per pixel, which is amazing from space. So MDA did not believe in the project. They let it go. They spun it off and raised $70 million and actually built it. The camera is up there. It's being tested as we speak. Some imagery has been seen of, and there's even a plan now to build another one for the American payload, which will be launched in 2 years, I believe. So, and they want to put multiple video camera, and the, you know, obviously it's to give a view of space to, and it, the imagery will be streamed online for all to see. You obviously the UN will be able to buy some bandwidth for, I don't know, a monitoring events to, like in Egypt, you know, like protest or whatever, or refugees crossing borders. They will actually have a video and be able to hold an image or an area for 90 to 90 seconds at a time. So that's going to be a first, because all we have are typically still cameras in space. So I believe Skybox, the company that builds CubeSat satellite, has tried as well a video camera since then. So I think that's going to be the future of space, going to be video, hopefully, which will give everybody a chance to, you know, if you're not an astronaut, at least you can have a view of the Earth going around and seeing it in the different eyes.
So that's not online yet?
The launch for the platform to view the imagery is planned for July next month, from the last update I got from them, which obviously is from the CTO. So we don't know, but I mean, there's been delays on the program, obviously trying to get accuracy and being able to have the camera hold a specific spot on Earth. You know, there's been some testing that were required, so there's been a bit of delays, but last I heard was July would be the beginning streaming on their platform, which is basically everybody with an internet connection will be able to view the videos.
And it's spelt a little unusually.
Earthcast, yeah. I don't know where they that was probably from the same meeting in Moscow, but which was probably a vodka field, but they just basically spell it U-R-T-H-E, cast. So instead of the normal Earth, yeah. So maybe it was done by a French, which I could say that it's not because I speak French, but.
And one of the other points you made is that money to be made in space is on the ground, because that's where the money is.
Yeah, there were some interesting articles that I fell on a few months back, which basically there was a Freakonomic blog where they asked a lot of people about return on investment in space. And, you know, there's always that year, you know, age old argument that we shouldn't be spending money in space. We should be spending it on Earth solving our problems. And somebody came up with the clever argument that it is impossible to spend money in space. Nobody will take our money up there. It has to be spent on Earth, creating jobs, creating technology. So it is actually being spent, which is a pretty good argument when you think about it. And, you know, like you always look at, like I said earlier, if NASA was to benefit from all the patents and all the money they generated, it's a self-sustainable program. And you see countries like China and India now investing heavily in space, and you have to wonder why they are doing it, considering they have, you know, a lot of social problems they need to take care of, but they still see the benefit of investing in space. And you see, you know, engineers from China, you know, like there's a lot of engineers kids getting interested in it because of the space program. It's a race with India to try to get to Mars, and same thing in India. So, you know, countries like Canada and Australia benefit from, indirectly from, would benefit from a program like this, because it gets kids excited. I want to study science instead of business or whatever. And it is an asset for a country to have so many people interested in science, for sure. So,
you also mentioned about base mining and mining automation.
Yeah, so basically, I mean, when I was asked where Australia's niche might be, because Canada found the niche with robotics, which was not an obvious thing at the time, you know, putting a robot in space, why? You know, like that was the first question that always came up. And then when they did it, well, okay, that makes sense. 10 years ago, space mining was far-fetched. Nobody thought it was possible. But they landed on a comet recently, and everybody stopped laughing. Like, it might be closer than we think. And there's actually a few companies in the U.S. that are actually putting together a program to do it, to get it done. And they're backed by Richard Branson, Larry Page from Google. They have some backers that are not, they're businessmen and they want to make money. They're not putting money there just for the fun of it. So you have to believe that they're serious about it. The beauty of it is that the government program like NASA would probably never have done it, but because of the switch to the private sector, now the space is controlled by the private sector more and more. Even NASA is, asking other companies, private companies, to bring their equipment into space because they don't want to do it themselves. So the private sector is driving it, and believe me, if there's $1 trillion worth of platinum up there, somebody's going to pay to get it, go get it, and they will have the resources to do it. And the thing is, the beauty of developing a technology for space like this is that whatever is developed to do either exploration or processing of the material up there will benefit whichever company develops the technology, will be able to sell it here as well at the same time. So their return on investment might be a lot faster than just the space program itself. Just look at exploration. Right now, when you explore for mining on Earth, you have to have a grid, have drill hundreds of holes to try to map the ore body underground. Well, there's, geophysics with with magnets and all that is being used on Earth, but will probably be the only option they have up there. So it will have to be developed even further and all that. And if it is, it's going to benefit exploration on Earth as well. So maybe drilling will be down and they can map more accurately with magnets or electromagnetic systems. So there's definitely a benefit that will be felt almost instantly for whatever is developed to go up there. Because if they want to mine an asteroid, they need to bring back the gold, not the whole rock with the 1% gold in it, because the whole rock will cost too much to bring back. So they need to process that up there. So automating the process up there will help automate the process here and make mining companies more efficient, safer. They can mine faster and hopefully in a more sustainable way as well. So there's definitely, I think if Australia was to look for a niche, that might be it, and the time might be now to actually look into it. You have the mining giants are typically Australian companies. Rio Tinto is probably the most advanced company in automation, and right now they're investing heavily in a program to automate their production. So that's, if they were to develop a program that would look into a space thing, they could apply it to what they do on the ground right away. So there's, for sure, the fact that it's not driven by government will probably bring us closer to space mining than ever before. I think Australia has a place in space, and it for Australians who want to work in space, I think it's probably the best time to have been involved in it. For young engineers out there, I would say just go for it. And you don't need to be... And we're not only talking about space engineers, because if they go mining in space, they will need, material engineer, mechanical engineer, mining engineers. And, the best example I have is the COO of Earthcast has a Bachelor of Arts in History, and he's a COO of a space company. So you can dream big, and you don't have to be a space engineer to do so.
Well, Mark Baudry, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That was Mark Baudry, Managing Director of the Hexigeo Group, talking about the lessons from Canada's successful space industries that Australia can learn. Next up, Singularity by Paul Rhodes.
This should be the last song I ever write. In a transcendental world, it'll be a worthless piece of shite. Along with all the endeavors of humankind. Against the computer brains, transhuman mind. So shut up and wait for the singularity. What you say and do is meaningless to the greatness that will be. I was blind, but now I see. I shut up and wait for the singularity. He knows his potent power. He thinks about it while he's taking a shower. It says it will be good, but some think it will be bad. But good and bad human concern. So shut up and wait for the singularity. What you say and do is meaningless to the greatness that will be. I once was blind, but now I see. I shut up and waited for the singularity.
And that's all from us this week on Diffusion. Both my computers and my phone have now died. I produced this show on an ancient 250 megabyte RAM laptop I had in the cupboard. That is just a quarter of a gig. Would you like to hear your voice on Diffusion? Would you like to join us? We need more people contributing stories to Diffusion. You can send your contributions, opinions, congratulations, helpful suggestions and donations to science@diffusionradio.com. That's science@diffusionradio.com. And please do send me an email so I know you're listening and you'd like to hear more episodes. Please like the Diffusion Science Radio page on Facebook and rate us on iTunes. Maybe it'll help more people discover Diffusion. Follow me on Twitter at Ian Wolf. Checking production was Charles Willock. I produce Diffusion, which is broadcast around Australia on the Community Radio Network, including 2 HHH in Hornsby-Ku'ringai, 2NVR in Nambucca Valley, 2XX in Canberra, and 3MBR in the Mallee border districts of Victoria and South Australia. Diffusion is syndicated globally on the National Science Foundation's Science 360 internet radio station and also on astronomy.fm. Subscribe to our podcast on the Diffusion website, www.diffusionradio.com. That's www.diffusionradio.com. And check the website for videos and photos and links about this week's show. I'm Ian Wolf. Join us inside your audio device of choice for more science wondering next week on Diffusion Science Radio. And to take us out, here's more of Singularity by Paul Rhodes. One good-